Be prepared. That's the Boy Scouts marching song. Be prepared. As through life you march along, be prepared to hold your liquor pretty well. Don't write naughty words on walls if you can't spell. Be prepared to hide that pack of cigarettes. Don't make book if you cannot cover bets. Keep those reefers hidden where you're sure that they will not be found. And be careful not to smoke them when the scoutmaster's around, for he only will insist that they be shared. Be prepared. Be prepared. That's the Boy Scout's solemn creed. Be prepared. And be clean in word and deed. Don't solicit for your sister. That's not nice. Unless you get a good percentage of her price. Be prepared. And be careful not to do your good deeds when there's no one watching you. If you're looking for adventure of a new and different kind, and you come across a Girl Scout who is similarly inclined, don't be nervous, don't be flustered, don't be scared. Be prepared.
That was, of course, a voice from another era, Tom Lehrer, exhorting us to be prepared. Now we're going to hear an interview from anti-violence educator Jackson Katz, from whom we heard in episode 507, and you may find it helpful to think about money as he talks about sexual violence, how the money system as we know it has one person in charge, whoever has the money, which typically has been men. Women in the past were fairly much excluded from the economic system, except for prostitutes. And one person who, not having the money, has to submit to the demands of whoever is paying. So, in other words, it's a hierarchy in disguise. If there wasn't a central point from which all the money emanated, it wouldn't necessarily be a hierarchy. And many times money has worked like that, but the money which is issued from central banks does work like that. So that thought I'll leave with you as we hear Jackson Katz on domination, male violence against women, and the need to look deeper than the bad apples approach, which says it is personal responsibility solely and the system is not to blame. He starts by elaborating in his film when he asks boys, what does it take to be a real man, when, as well as physical toughness, not being homosexual, they talk about providing. And that's another echo of earlier shows in which we spoke of the hidden nature of women's work. Hidden because it doesn't get accounted for. Like the work of nature, it's invisible, and because it's given, it's deemed not to exist. But before we get off on a gift economy tangent, let's get back to Jackson Katz and ideas of male as the provider.
You know, very often we say, well, what's wrong with being strong? What's wrong with being a provider? Sometimes that's an argument that says, you know, are you saying that these qualities are bad?
Right, and of course that's a misreading of people make those kind of simplistic misreadings all the time. Of course it doesn't mean it's anything wrong with being strong or being a provider. And both men and women can be strong and be providers. It's not, those are not gendered qualities, strength and taking care of your family. Those are not gendered qualities. I mean, the problem is not being strong or being a provider. The problem is how you define strength. And the problem is that if you define strength in physical terms and being in control and physical control, and then you're leading to, you know, the inevitability of violence in relationships.
And I think that's where it was interesting to look at and leading toward down this road. If we're talking to our young, you know, our young people, you know, and we say we have an 11 or 12 year old boy in our household, and they're already getting these kinds of messages, and we're looking at sexuality, then what are the kinds of things that this kind of behavior might play out in the terms of sexual behavior?
Well, I think, Tiffany, in the context of that question and concern of parents, I mean, I think we have to talk about the primary form of sexual socialization in the culture for young boys, and it's pornography. So what these boys are learning in pornography, and that's by far the most important form of sex education or sex miseducation in the culture. What they're learning in pornography, boys are and men are, about manhood, is not that sexual relationships involve mutual pleasures and taking care of each other's feelings. In pornography, the way that manhood is constructed, generally speaking, and I'm talking about the mainstream of pornography, I'm not talking about extremes, the way that manhood is constructed in pornography or defined is basically men are in complete control over women who are essentially there to service men's sexual needs. And at the same time that men are being serviced by women sexually, they're degrading them, they're ridiculing them, they're calling them names. I mean, the level of eroticized abuse and violence in the primary form of sexual socialization for boys is astounding. And in the absence of good, healthy sexual talk, sexual education, parents talking to their kids honestly and openly about these issues, I think boys are getting a very twisted and distorted understanding of what it means to be a man in sexual terms.
I mean, we're also looking, I'm looking at some statistics here. We have 99.8% of the people in prison convicted of rape are men. And I think the other piece to this is looking at and thinking, well, my son would never do something like that. And I think in your book, The Macho Paradox, Why Some Men Hurt Women and How All Men Can Help, is looking at the chapter that specifically talks about what is, I think it takes a village to rape a woman. And you talk about, again, repeating some of the other things that people talk about rapist values, and looking at not necessarily, you know, the extremes of those, but talking about sort of this other mentality of maybe a college kid who, you know, doesn't really take no for an answer. And how this all plays out in exactly what you're talking about as far as the macho paradox. Can you talk a little bit about It Takes a Village to Rape a Woman? What exactly
sure.
do you mean,
I mean
by that?
Well, I mean, the basic idea behind that title is that the problem of rape is the problem of these sick and aberrant individuals who somehow crawl out of the ooze to do their bad deeds is a very naive one. That, in fact, rape, sadly, and sexual violence is much more common than that would suggest. And the men who commit rape and the boys who commit rape and sexual violence are not, you know, psychologically twisted. They're not sociopathic in most cases. Obviously, there are some who are. But the vast majority of men and boys who are sexually abusive and sexually violent are not the caricature of a monster. They're much more normal than that. They're much more like average guys. And I think that makes a lot of people very uncomfortable, because if the most men who were rapists were so sick and different from the rest of us, then we could rest a little easy and say, okay, it's not really about us, it's about those crazy guys. But the fact is that's not the case in most cases, and so therefore we have to look internally, or we have to, as a society, be introspective. We have to say, what is it about our society that's producing all these abusive men? And what about the institutions of our society that sort of socialized boys are located in this problem of rape? And, I mean, that's a little more, to say the least, discomforting to a lot of people, including parents, and parents of sons, and I am a parent of a son, because, you know, we have to look at ourselves and the ways in which we're exposing our kids to a set of ideas and values that are, I think, in so many ways, very antisocial. And the media culture is one place. I'm not saying it's the only place, but it's one place that I spend a lot of my time examining how what I call rapist values are normalized in men's lives.
the problem with this idea of the concept of rape is that we tend to, as a society, still think about sort of the alleyway and, you know, the dark shadowy figure, and not recognizing that more often than not, that it's actually someone that we know. How do we talk to our young boys about this, about how to be with women in regards to sexuality? I mean, they're getting such mixed messages. You know, you look at the videos, women are seen as property. The more girls that you have hanging off of you, dripping off of you, the more man that you are. And thinking, you know, well, I have a son, he's 11 or 12, but you know what, he doesn't behave that way. So I don't really need to say anything to him. How do we contradict the messages that they're seeing, and how do we know what kind of man that son is going to be?
Well, I mean, those are really good questions. I think we need, among other things, widespread implementation of media literacy in schools and in every other educational setting. We need, in other words, we need to critically examine both, by the way, both kids and parents need to be media literate. We need to be thoughtful and knowledgeable about not only what our kids are watching and listening to, but we need to be up on them, the latest thinking about those things, and try to understand how various values are inculcated both in kids and in adults through media. And by the way, the effects of media are much more about normalizing behavior, creating social norms and producing them and then reproducing them, than they are about causing people to act in certain ways. It has more to do with defining what is masculine and what is feminine, and the media's role in all of that. And I think parents of sons need to be, you know, especially vigilant, because to say that, you know, oh, our kids are, my son's fine and, you know, he's not really affected by all this, I think it's just naive in the extreme. It doesn't mean that all boys are going to become abusive. Of course, most are not going to be. But to think that they're not affected, that boys and young men aren't affected by the norms of masculine behavior that are presented to them on a daily basis in media, to think that that's not affecting them, it's ridiculous. Of course it's affecting them.
Yeah, and if people are affected by the media images presented to them, how much more affected are they by the structure of their thoughts, things which they learn in early childhood, metaphors, as George Lakoff points out, such as up being more, down being less, in money terms, rich being good, poor being bad, loads of money good, not much money not so good. Why do people call themselves broke when they have no money, as if they're like a broken machine? Behavioral economists have done experiments which show that money has an ability to decrease people's sensitivity to pain. And one of the main arguments used to justify pornography, or sweatshops for that matter, is that the people involved are getting paid. I would suggest that a lot of violence springs from the competition for money. Violence is legitimate within the frame of money because it's a tough old Hobbesian old dog-eat-dog survival of the fittest, and although Richard Dawkins later reviewed what he said about the selfish gene and wondered whether he shouldn't have called it the cooperative gene, because it's not as if genes exist in isolation. Garrett Hardin wished he'd called his Tragedy of the Commons Tragedy of the Unmanaged Commons. Why then did these competitive frames stick in people's mind? Because it resonated with the more or less brutal, but in any case, psychopathic struggle for money, in which mercy and feeling consideration for others is deemed as a weakness by the very system that says those who have money shall eat and those who don't shan't. I would scale up Jackson Katz's thought that it takes a village to perform a rape, and say it takes a global village to rape a planet, whilst, as we have studied many times on the show, the world is being rapidly destroyed for the benefit of only very few people in material terms. A large number of people are engaged in that rape and pillage, and the very large majority of those who endeavour to stop this plunder are still engaged in a personal struggle for survival, because the abundance, which is our natural birthright, has been commandeered and brought within the realm, as Jackson Katz puts it, of rapist values. Now, I've noticed in Bangladesh there is just a complete lack of any of the stress and paranoia about dealing with children, because the child sex thing just hasn't been hyped. And it seems to me that the stress and the attention paid to it is actually generating the problem. The same way, perhaps, that although drugs are effectively decriminalized in the Netherlands, the drug use rate amongst the Dutch population is lower than in many countries in which they're illegal, a move which was supposed to decrease usage rates, and that's a dynamic which most governments just do not want to explore, exposing the hypocrisy of the project. But to return to the issue of the war on sex, let's explore another way in which children can grow into their sexuality, other than porn or government-sponsored therapy programs to try to teach them that sex is bad. This is a section of Kenneth Doust's program New World Notes, which explains about Ghanaian puberty rights. In contrast to the council's divide-and-conquer approach, reflect on how you might feel to grow up in this society, one in which traditional values of community, solidarity, and communication are fostered, rather than looked at as a threat to the powers that be.
This is from the official Nation of Ghana website. Please forgive my pronunciation. As Dr. Johnson said of Shakespeare, I have little Latin, less Greek, and hardly any Ashanti Tui to speak of. After the naming ceremony, the next important ritual is the puberty rites. Among the well-preserved puberty rites are those of the Ashanti ethnic group. These ceremonies mark the entry of young women into adulthood. In Ghana, only a few ethnic groups have initiation rites for men. These are done in secret and not given as much prominence as that for young women. In the Akan culture, Akan is a broader category that includes the Ashanti ethnic group and a few others. In Akan cultures, women represent the beauty, purity, and dignity of the society and are guarded against corruption by our traditional laws and regulations. The most lasting impressions about life and the character of children are built during their early and formative years, which they spend mostly with their mothers. So the Akans believe that they need properly trained mothers with good morals to bring up good children. Under the supervision of the queen mother of the town or village, young women who have had their first menstruation are secluded from the community for a period between 2 and 3 weeks. Now they are taught the secrets of womanhood. During this period of seclusion, the girls are given lessons in sex education and birth control. They are also taught how to relate to men properly, so that they can maintain a good marriage and their dignity in society. After the period of seclusion, a ceremony is held which is attended by the chief and almost everybody in the community. The newly initiated women are dressed scantily with the very beautiful African beads and cosmetics showing off their vital statistics. Young men of marriageable age troop there to feast their eyes on the young women and to select their prospective wives. Amidst drumming and dancing, the rituals are carried out with the spirit of Oinankupang Kwame, Asasiya'a, and the departed ancestors invoked to bless the participants and ensure their protection, blessing, and fertility during their period of motherhood. According to traditional law, no woman is allowed to get married without having gone through the puberty rites, and every young woman must remain a virgin prior to this. These laws ensure that the young women grow up disciplined enough to control their sexuality and to prevent them from premature motherhood and unwanted babies. So important are these laws that any woman who gets pregnant or breaks her virginity before the rites are performed is sometimes ostracized, together with the man responsible for it. A few things strike me here. The fertility rite is social and communal, not a private matter between a girl, her mother, and the school nurse. Believe it or not, puberty is related to sex, and sex is related to the community, and sex is related to spirituality, and to the gods, and to our ancestors, and to the girl's adoption of new roles in society. The Ashanti don't get the talk for 5 minutes by an embarrassed parent and a kotex tossed at them. They get a 3-week sacred retreat conducted by the queen mother of the village, where they are taught not just to avoid roller skating or cold showers during their period, but how to behave as a woman, how to act as a wife, and how to practice birth control. Menstruation is not just a secret annoyance that prevents you from playing volleyball, and at best promises that 5 years down the road, you'll be able to wear a prom dress and make new and important friends, unlike the losers you're friends with now. It's a public sign, honored by the community, blessed by the gods and departed ancestors. A public sign that the girl has crossed the threshold into womanhood. The multiple ceremonies marking this transition are in turn sacred, practical, and erotic. It's in part a debutante ball, but much more. The Ghana webpage has a photo of two lovely young women, each naked except for a rattan sort of top hat, beads, and an elaborate loincloth with trains that nearly reach the ground front and rear but leave the sides exposed. They have the breasts of young women, and they're wearing some light gray-colored cosmetic powder on their nipples that highlights them. Remember the slogan from the 70s? Black is beautiful? I believed it then, and I believe it still. Now, if you asked a lot of Americans how would you feel about your 14-year-old daughter exposing her breasts in public, I don't imagine puberty rites would get a lot of public support. Few American fathers deal well with their inevitable, not entirely platonic attraction to their daughters, and few mothers want to hear the truth from the mirror, mirror on the wall when they ask, "Who's the most desirable little number in this household?" Yes, there's a lot of mental ill health in this society, and it's not going to go away by just clicking your heels and reciting, "There's no state like sanity, there's no state like sanity." But it's not just the parents' neuroses, it's the economic, quote, system, unquote. When will your daughter have her first period? Oh, 11, 12, maybe 13. When will she be ready to marry? Oh, maybe 25 when she gets out of law school, or 30 if she's pursuing a PhD in mathematics. When should she cast aside her virginity? Oh, ideally, never. But also ideally, I'll settle for her wedding night, say 15 years after she reaches puberty. Right. And with luck, when do you expect this event will happen? Oh, probably by the time she's 17, 5 years into puberty. Get it? We can't have puberty rites in the USA because Americans, reasonably enough, associate puberty with sex and babies. And Americans don't want their daughters to have sex, and really don't want their daughters to have babies, until they're married. And the unnatural economic system we have doesn't allow middle-class or working-class adulthood, and doesn't encourage marriage, until you get your first real job, which may be when you're 21, or 25, or 30, up to 20 years after you reach puberty. And when you reach puberty, what is your role in society? Consumer! Congratulations! You're now what our marketing department calls a tween. Check out our new line of tween cosmetics, tampons, and t-shirts. Not like those stuffy old cosmetics, tampons, and t-shirts your clueless old mother wears.
That was Kenneth Doust's New World Notes. newworldnotes.blogspot.com. I've taken that clip out of context. He's not quite that zany and madcap. He's actually comparing the Ghanaian puberty rites with a Kotex advert from America in the 50s or 60s, which is instructing middle-class women on how they can have the talk with their daughters. He makes the point that our attitudes to what is good and proper in the world of sex are, of course, closely connected to the economic, social, political, technological systems which are prevailing in our lives. The key technological change of the last generation has been the internet, the rise and rise of the porn industry. And that was the actual inspiration for this show. I saw a film called Price of Pleasure. Not actually very suitable for radio. Even the soundtrack contained some pretty unsavory elements. It would have been a lot of work to stick within the FCC guidelines, but worth looking out for. The film suggested that pornography was having a rise and rise, that mainstream culture was becoming more pornographic, and pornographic culture becoming more violent, especially violent from men to women, and from whites to women of colour. Now, whether that is a cause or an effect of changes in society, I couldn't say. But the film also talked about commodification, the fact that under capitalism, everything is for sale. And I was impressed by its arguments that the process is degrading, especially degrading to women. And returning to the title of the show, The War on Sexual Relationships, you can see pornography as a kind of a fast food of sexual gratification, something that is packaged, mass-produced, sold, something perhaps with an unnatural or chemical component, not something that springs naturally, something that grows from an intimacy. Why do people not talk about making love the way that they used to? Why are people always having sex? Ultimately, the war on sexual relationships seems to me to be a divide-and-conquer strategy. Not only division between people, spreading fear and mistrust, the same way that the witch hunts were used to destroy the cohesiveness of European society, but also division within oneself, training a young generation that sex is bad, divorcing the sexual from the physical. This terrible word, inappropriate, which has become the new wrong. People don't talk about what is right and wrong, which could be a personal decision, but appropriateness and inappropriateness, which springs from guidelines, is the new criterion for behavior. And when it springs from human-to-human relationship, the sexual part of life, sexual component is something sacred and mystic and beyond putting a price on, and it's therefore threatening for the capitalist system, and it's also empowering. So I wonder if when people engage in human-to-machine sex, human-to-magazine sex, when they allow sexuality to be divorced from human relationships, does it perhaps become something cheaper, something less potent, something which is under the control of those who would enslave us all? That's a philosophical point. I haven't thought too much about this. I'm going to let the last word in the show go to Robert Jensen, who appears in the film. This is an interview from August 2008.
It was almost 30 years ago that women feminists initiated a vigorous campaign against the purveyors of pornography. In Vancouver, there were various protests, I remember, against the first video store that mainly marketed porn. It was called the Red Hot Video. What can you tell us about the period of anti-porn, that period of anti-porn analysis and activism?
Yes, for many years in the United States and in places like Canada as well, the argument about pornography was really between moralistic conservatives, usually rooted in a religious tradition, and liberals who argued for sexual freedom. That debate was really exploded in the late 70s and early 80s by feminists who looked at pornography not from a moralistic point of view, but as a question of power and a question of men's oppression of women. And one of the places in the culture where men's violence against women is reinforced and deepened. The primary figure in that was Andrea Dworkin in the United States, who in the late 70s started asking a simple question: why do we live with epidemic levels of sexual violence in our society? And not surprisingly, Andrea looked at the storytelling. You know, the way we understand ourselves in any culture comes from the stories we tell. And of course, in this culture, we're talking about mass media as the primary storyteller. So Andrea, focusing not only on pornography but also mainstream media, started to look at the ways in which those stories reinforce a sense of men's domination over women and justify and legitimate men's violence against women. The pornography industry at that point, again, the late 70s, early 80s, was very small compared to today. But I think Andrea saw deeply into the genre and realized that the core of pornography, again, here we're talking about a commercial, mass-marketed, mass-media genre. We're not talking about any potential sexual expression. We're talking about a specific mass-mediated product in the world today. Andrea saw that the core of that was a dynamic of domination and subordination, that men's domination and women's subordination was being sexualized or eroticized. In the 30 years since that analysis originally emerged, we've seen more and more evidence that, in fact, the feminist critique was accurate. We've seen a dramatic expansion of pornography, and we've seen a dramatic increase in the level of overt cruelty and degradation against women that the industry puts on film.
Well, what would you use as markers for this notion that pornography, rather than maintaining even the level of presence that it had in our culture 30 years ago, has in fact expanded and become more normalized, quote unquote?
Well, there's several markers of this. One, of course, is legal changes. The obscenity laws in the United States are almost never enforced. Society has accepted that mass media genre in a certain way. By that, I don't mean, of course, that there are no people objecting. But you can see that the ability to make money from pornography has sort of paved the way for a kind of mainstream acceptance. You can see it in the raw numbers, the growth of the industry. Estimates there in the United States alone, something probably between $10 and $15 billion a year spent on pornography. And of course, all of this is going forward in a technological environment in which more and more people have more and more readily accessible pornography available to them, including increasingly younger people. So the internet, home recorders and DVDs and videos, all of that has made it technologically possible to expand. We see that social mores change and the legal response changes. So what you have in the United States today, and this is true to some degree of Canada as well, I think, as well as much of Western Europe, a kind of acceptance of pornography as part of the mainstream pop culture. You see this in the way that pornography performers will show up on mainstream news and entertainment shows. Jenna Jameson, one of the most famous, probably the most famous porn star in U.S. history, at one point had a best-selling book on the New York Times list. There's just been a slow move in which pornography has become more part of the mainstream. And at the same time, mainstream pop culture has become increasingly pornographic. So if you look at both of those trends, pornography coming into the center of the culture and the traditional pop culture, by that we mean network television, Hollywood movies, becoming increasingly pornographic, borrowing the codes and conventions of pornography. At this point, when I talk to young people, that means anybody younger than me, of course, and I'm 50. So, but when I talk to my students, people my son's age, teenagers, early 20s, they've grown up in a world where pornography is so commonplace that they often don't even think to question it. It's just part of the cultural landscape into which they were born and raised.
In your book, you speak of a rape culture that isn't even recognized as rape. Could you?
Yeah, one of the disturbing aspects of the levels of sexual violence in contemporary American culture, and I don't want to assume that Canada is always like the U.S., although I think there are some common themes here, is not only the level of violence, but the degree to which that violence is invisible. So, for instance, in the 1980s, there was a study released in which a number of women whose self-description of experiences they had met the legal definition of rape. And I don't remember the statistics off the top of my head, but something like a third of those women did not identify themselves as rape victims, even though their own experience met that legal definition. Perhaps more chilling is men often engage in activity that they self-report that meets the legal definition of rape, and they are adamant that they have not raped. And men often, in fact, are very blunt in saying they intend to engage in the same behavior in the future. So you have a level of sexual violence, and we're not talking about gray areas here. We're talking about acts that meet the legal definition of rape, which are not even recognized by rape by a significant minority of the victims and a majority of the perpetrators. In a pornographic culture, that problem is only going to get worse because the violence, the cruelty, the degradation that's so part of the core of the pornographic dynamic is more and more present, more and more part of the background in young people's lives. So it's not surprising, I think, to predict that we're going to see even a greater kind of invisibility of sexual violence in that pornographic culture.
Do we have any estimates at all of the number of men who consume pornography?
Well, jokingly, I always say that if you take a pornography consumer to mean somebody who at some point in his life has consumed pornography, the percentage of men in contemporary American culture who are porn consumers is roughly 100%, especially for younger people. It's simply a given. Unless someone grows up in a particular social or family situation in which that is unavailable to them, the assumption is, when I talk to young men, that they've all seen pornography. And when I ask, they all shrug and say, yes, of course, we've seen it. It doesn't mean all are avid consumers. But exposure to pornography in this culture right now, for younger people especially, is universal. Even men of my own age, I was born in 1958, exposure to pornography was pretty routine. The change, of course, has been both in the ease with which one can access pornography, and again, the intensity of the cruelty and degradation toward women, that has changed. So younger men, compared to men of my generation, have seen pornography. They tend to have seen more pornography, and they tend to have seen a more intensely brutal pornography. And that's the difference, and that's why I think many of us who have always been concerned about the domination and subordination that's so central to pornography, are even more concerned than ever given these social and technological changes.
Now, you did what we call academic research. What methodology did you use for your analysis mm-hmm. of pornography?
Well, one line of research on pornography has been out of psychology, very traditional experimental psychology, where you expose some group of people to a pornographic stimulus and others to a non-pornographic, and you try to use various measures, surveys about attitudes, to find out what that might do. That line of research has been pursued for a number of years now, and from my point of view, produces very little in the way of reliable knowledge. There are certain questions that we simply have difficulty answering with much specificity. So the fundamental question that animated a lot of early research, does pornography use, especially the habitual use of the more brutal kinds of pornography, lead to increases in sexual violence? That's a question that I would say we don't know the answer to with any definitive certainty, and we probably never will, that the intellectual tools available to us probably aren't adequate to answer that question. So rather than continue to try and pursue that line of research, what I and others in the feminist camp have done is look at other ways to understand the phenomenon. So, for instance, I did a series of in-depth interviews with both convicted sex offenders and self-identified pornography users to try and understand their experience. There's been a number of studies that have looked at women's experience, that is, women, especially women who are partnered with men who use pornography, what is their experience like? So trying to understand the effects of pornography on people's lives can be explored through conversation in a research setting, conversation that's systematic and detailed. Also looking at the content of pornography, I've done a series of studies over the last 10 years or so, just looking at a representative sample of the best selling and renting pornographic videos to try and chart trends in the presentation of sexuality in it. And that's where the trend is so clear that the brutality, the cruelty and degradation toward women, and also, by the way, the overt racism in pornography is intensifying. Well, all of those things, I think, we have to approach with a certain kind of humility. We're never going to know the answers to some of these complex questions. Just like if you ask, what's the effect of a steady diet of violent television on young people? Well, it's a hard question to answer with much clarity, but we want to explore to the degree we can answer that question. And I think the evidence on pornography is quite clear that the trends in content are toward an ever-increasing cruelty and degradation, and that the effects of it are easy to see at some level. So the number of women, for instance, who report what the psychologists would call marital dissatisfaction, women in relationships with men who use pornography heavily, the evidence of that is mounting, both from psychologists and anecdotal evidence from divorce lawyers and therapists. So I think we can chart the trends, and I think there's a fair amount of research now which establishes those trends. The question is, what do we want to do about it? As a culture, do we want to engage in an honest discussion about how a very predatory corporate capitalist system has commodified, all of our lives down to the most intimate spaces of our lives, and done that in a patriarchal and white supremacist context, which means that those images that are being sold are not just any old images of sexuality. They're images of sexuality that degrade women and reinforce racism.
From your discussions with men and your observations of these pornographic materials, what would you say is the appeal to a man of pornography?
I've talked to many, many men over the last 20 years that I've worked on this and tried to examine my own experience, because I grew up in this culture too, and as a young man, a child, I had exposure to pornography as well. And I think one of the obvious things one can say is pornography gives men a sense of control. When you use a woman sexually through a pornographic media, you have control. Literally now with DVDs and the computer, the ability to fast forward, rewind, replay, men's control of women sexually is complete in pornography, both in the way that men use it and in the images they're watching, because those images are overwhelmingly of men controlling women sexually. So that's one sense of appeal. But I also think we can look at a kind of deeper and perhaps more almost spiritual level in some sense and ask, what does it mean to live in a society in which we are, you know, defined as consumers, where everything is about consumption? And there I think pornography as an issue is very useful, not just to point out the reality of the industry and what happens to the women in the industry, not just to look at the direct effects on people's lives, but also to ask, what kind of people are we becoming when those most basic of experiences, such as sexuality, and whatever one thinks about sexuality, it's core to who we are. I always think of sexuality as a kind of a form of communication. It's a way we try to understand ourselves, understand other people. Well, what happens when all of that is put into this commodified, mediated form? I think there's a lot we should think about in the way in which we've accepted in our lives so much of the commodification and mediation. What does it mean to be a human being when some of your most basic experiences you buy and experience through a screen? I think these are profound questions that we, again, have to engage.
When I was reading your descriptive material of actual porn films, I found it very emotionally grueling, in the same way that I find descriptions of torture at Abu Ghraib revolting. You comment on the cruelty of pornography. So is there any connection between pornography and other dimensions of war-making, economic misery, where women and children also are the main victims?
Yeah. Well, it is grueling to read those descriptions. And it was grueling to watch those films, I can tell you. And in fact, I pretty much decided I'm going to no longer do this kind of research. The emotional toll is really quite extreme. A friend of mine joked once, he said, too bad you can't subcontract that workout to somebody who enjoys it. But of course, it's the enjoyment that keeps us from seeing the cruelty. And men often tell me, for instance, that I watch pornographic films and I don't see the kind of cruelty you're talking about. And of course, in some sense, they're being honest. They don't see it because that cruelty is being masked, being overwhelmed by the sexual pleasure. When we're engaged in sexual arousal and masturbation, which of course is the primary function of pornography, to facilitate masturbation for men, our critical faculties often do shut off. It's only when you step back and look at it in that more analytic style that you see that cruelty. And then it's overwhelming, I agree. And then I think the next step is, as you make, is very important, to see the way that we accept cruelty in the culture in many, many ways. So, for instance, you know, homelessness on the street, to take a very pertinent example. You can walk outside this studio and see people living on the street. Why do we accept that as a culture? There are lots of societies in human history where that would have been unthinkable. The way we wage war, the incredible barbarism of contemporary warfare. War is never pretty, of course, but we've developed weapons and a certain insulation from the effect of those weapons that allows a allegedly civilized society to destroy people in ways that are almost unthinkable. And of course, the most direct example, the torture, the way in which in the United States today, a significant portion of the U.S. population has accepted what the Bush administration likes to call, you know, extreme interrogation methods, which is, you know, a polite way of saying torture. There's been a backlash to it, but I was more struck by the way in which the dominant culture in the United States just kind of shrugged at those images from Abu Ghraib. Rush Limbaugh, the right-wing radio commentator, famously said, well, it's nothing more than a fraternity prank. And in a way, I think there was something important in what he said, because fraternity pranks are another way in which cruelty is institutionalized. Hazing is a form of torture, in a sense. So I think, again, the pornography issue and the connections you're making should lead us to step back and ask, what kind of society have we become? How has this domination-subordination dynamic, what we might think of as the inevitability of hierarchy and abuse, how much have we simply accepted that? How much are we, those of us in more privileged sectors of society, such as myself, for instance, how much have we become insulated from the human reaction to the suffering of others? In other words, to put it more bluntly, do we have, as a society, the capacity for empathy? Or have we lost our empathetic responses? And I think it's quite clear that when individually a person or collectively a culture no longer has the capacity for empathy, that is to see the suffering of another person and react to it as a human being, then it's hard to imagine how that society can survive very long, because that is the death of a human being, the death of empathy. And I think similarly, it's the death of a culture.
We've been speaking about places like the United States and Canada, and you made some reference to Europe. How do we know anything about the universality of this pornography consumption?
Well, what we do know from looking across the globe is that pornography consumption is primarily a first world phenomenon. That is, it is something that people with access to money do. So when you look not only at pornography, but all of the what I would call the sexual exploitation industries, prostitution, stripping, sex tourism, when affluent men go to, you know, the less developed parts of the world on sex tours, where you know your travel agent will book your hotel and your plane and your prostitutes. Well, those are industries made possible by the gross economic inequality in the world. You have people with the money to spend, and you have people who are desperate and in those industries. So when you look across the globe, and I don't pretend to be a cross-cultural expert, but when you just take a first look at it, pornography consumption is not surprisingly concentrated in North America, in Europe, in Japan, in places where men have that kind of disposable income. And the people who are in those industries tend to come from that sector of society, which is less economically stable and more desperate. So there's a lot of trafficking out of the third world, out of the former Soviet bloc. The patterns are pretty clear. And again, they are very much like the patterns that we see across the board economically. Where is sweatshop labor located? Well, it's not located in, you know, Cambridge, Massachusetts, outside of Harvard University, staffed by Harvard grads, right? I mean, it's all pretty simple. We're looking at the realities of not only capitalism, but an increasingly predatory capitalist system in which human beings are defined either as raw materials, inputs into production, or consumers and nothing else. And I think when I talk about pornography, and over the years this has intensified, I increasingly want to foreground the role of capitalism. It's not that there haven't been sexually explicit representations in other times and places in human history, but taking the representation of sex, turning it into a for-profit, mass-mediated commodity, is really a function of the post-World War II era. What we call pornography, that is, this mass-mediated, mass-marketed enterprise, is really a product of the last 60 years. And I think we have to see it in that context and see it in the context of capitalism. And again, it's difficult to confront, but I think it raises very fundamental questions about the nature of the system we live in, patriarchal, white supremacist, capitalist, and imperial. That defines a very grim world. Pornography, for me, is one avenue into understanding that world. It's not the only one. It's not necessarily the most important one. But I would argue that the feminist critique of pornography is very much in line with a fundamental left critique of economic inequality, a fundamental left critique of first world imperialism, and the crucial critiques of white supremacy and patriarchy that should always be at the heart of how we see the world.
We haven't defined, and I haven't asked you to define, mm-hmm. pornography. In fact, in your book, you referred to the discussion about definition to be really a dodge from facing up to the reality of it. But those who defend pornography often use the question of definition. They use the question of it's natural, and they use the notion of erotic. It is part of the human imagination and experience. How do you respond to all of those?
At some level, I agree. Sexuality is part of being human, and our creative impulses are part of being human. I can't imagine a world in which people were not sexual and not creative. But I think we can distinguish between the human desire to use our creative capacity to explore what is essentially the mystery of being human. And that's really what art does. Art explores those things that are beyond our rational faculties. I always say that's why there's so much art about sex and about God, because we don't understand either. People say, God, what do you know? Who knows what they're talking about, right? And so there's a lot of art that explores those things, and I think that's appropriate and healthy. I also think we can distinguish between that creative instinct in the human animal and an industry, a pornography industry, that's rooted in a white supremacist and patriarchal culture and commodifies everything, including that intimate dimension of our lives. Well, that industry produces a product. And while we may not be able to provide some, you know, bright line definition to distinguish between those gray areas in which sexual expression that is healthy morphs into pornography, which is destructive and degrading, I think for purposes of conversation, we can certainly distinguish between, let's say, a pornographic video in which five men sexually violate a woman using degrading terms and insults, and, you know, like, this is not appropriate to go much further on the radio, of course. Can we not distinguish between that and love poems, you know, poems that explore sexual desire? I can distinguish between those. Now, when you start talking about legal solutions, public policy, then the definitional question gets much more important. But at this point in the book, I'm not proposing a law. I'm not suggesting that the primary way to deal with this is legal. When we write laws, we have to define terms. And in fact, part of what the law does is define terms through its application. So I think we can distinguish between social issues that we need to discuss, in which there need not be perfect clarity about a definition. For instance, for purposes of discussion that we might have, I would say, well, let's define pornography as those products the pornography industry identifies as pornography. Go on a website which says, we sell pornography. That's what I'm talking about, right? Let the industry define it. And at the same time, as we move into public policy discussions, we will have to refine and clarify those definitions. But that happens through discussion. My main concern about the definitional dodge, as I call it, is people want to use that dodge to shut down the conversation. And I think that's basically, from my point of view, fear-based, that we are, as a culture, afraid to ask, what can we learn about this society from pornography? What can we learn about the entrenched nature of white supremacy and patriarchy? What can we learn about the really corrosive nature of corporate capitalism from pornography? That discussion doesn't need specific definitions. It needs an honesty and a willingness to, quite frankly, look in the mirror and ask, who have we become?
The rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shiny black
The media used for this episode are at www.unwelcomeguests.net/519. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.
By unwelcome travelers, another brave